Welcome to Rails with Jason. If you enjoyed today's episode and want more Rails tips and advice, head over to codewithjason.com, where I keep all my Rails articles and videos. Now on to the episode. Today I'm here with my guest, Nate Birkopec, Ruby Performance Consultant and author of The Complete Guide to Rails Performance. Nate, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jason. Thank you.
So you're joining us today from Japan. How are things in Japan today?
Tokyo. Things are pretty normal. It's a rainy day. If you're listening from the future, this is back when we all stayed inside for months at a time. And it's not too bad. You know, as far as Tokyo goes, we have a pretty big place that we're staying in here. So,
yeah, you open that sentence with things are pretty normal, which is actually
that's true. Yeah, that's actually a lie. that was a pretty bald-faced lie.
Anyway, you and I have been exchanging tweets and stuff lately regarding like hosting and all kinds of thoughts related to that stuff. So we're going to talk about topics related to that. And dear listener, Nate and I did zero prep, and we're just diving in, and you're hearing it straight from our heads or whatever. So,
right off the dome, as they say.
Off the dome. I'll tee things up a little bit by describing what I've been doing lately, which I've talked a little bit about on the show. But I've been working with AWS more and more. I'm in a job now where I'm responsible for the infrastructure, which is not as grand as it sounds. I'm the one single developer at the organization. We have two EC2 instances. It's small potatoes, but it's a lot of learning experiences for me. I'm getting an opportunity to see what's the difference between hosting on Elastic Beanstalk versus bare EC2 versus using something like Ansible. And then lately, this is not going to chronologically work out, but I had Kelsey Hightower on the show last week, except you will have heard this before. I don't know. I don't understand the passage of time. But he and I talked about Kubernetes and Docker. And so those are some options that I might explore soon. Mm. The options that you have when you're hosting off of Heroku, when you're hosting not on Heroku, that is, are basically infinite, and the landscape can be bewildering because there's a saying, when you have 1,000 options, you have no options. And sometimes I feel like that is the case. So that's where my head's been at. How about you, Nate?
Yeah, well, it's funny that you say small potatoes, because I think that sort of like encapsulates the problem, because for 80% of organizations that have deployed web apps, they're going to be doing 1,000 requests per minute or less for probably the lifetime of the business. And that kind of scale is almost like it's 1 to 2 node scale. It's like handful of nodes scale. And so there's very little actual demand for like the horizontal and vertical scaling of this, but somebody has to go set it up. And when it comes to deploying to a platform like AWS especially, but you know, all the Google Cloud, Azure, all of them have the same experience, you open up that like services list for the first time and you're like, oh my God, like what is all this stuff? I mean, the services window at AWS now is like comical. Like I remember when it wasn't. I remember when it was like 20 or 25 things and thinking that was a lot. But you click it open now and you're like, what the heck is this? I was looking at the AWS launch blog, I guess, or just, well, it might just be the AWS blog. And they're launching 15 new things a day. You know, like there's literally no way for anyone to keep track of all this anymore. But that doesn't solve your problem. Like you're there as the single or one of two developers, And you have to figure out how to get something listening to HTTP port 80, you know, hosted on AWS. And it's no easier than it was 10 years ago. But now it's even more confusing because of all these different options. You know, there's a million ways now, just from the AWS config alone, to deploy that type of service. Like, you've got Fargate, you've got EKS, you've got ECS, like all these options that did not exist five, even 2 or 3 years ago. And they're all legitimate ways to just get something listening to port 80, you know, on an IP address, right? So I feel like this burden comes down harder on people like you, because, you know, at Shopify or whatever, like, they have 15, 20 people that are paid full time to figure this stuff out for their business. And you have other stuff to do, and there's one of you, you know? So yeah, like I've been thinking about this a lot. You know, Heroku, you know, mm-hmm. is great, but I think there's other use cases and other reasons people are going to be looking at other stuff. I also have, you know, problems with Heroku. So like, I've been thinking about this as well.
I had a pretty interesting guest on the other day. Have you heard, Nate, of this tool Convox?
Yeah. Yeah. I asked this question on Twitter. I forgot how I phrased it, basically just asking, you know, what are people using to deploy their own Heroku? And Convox was mentioned very positively by a number of people.
Oh yeah, I found out about it because of you. Yeah. And then I had the CEO on the show like a few days ago. And so yeah, that sounds like a pretty interesting tool. I had tried, you might remember this, Nate, I had tried to launch like a Heroku but on AWS kind of tool back in the fall of 2019. And I discovered that it was going to be a gigantic amount of work. And I was like also way over my head from a technical perspective, because that's just not my background at all. But then I discovered this tool, which is like basically the same thing that I was trying to create, but they just like actually did a good job of it and knew what they were doing. Mm-hmm. So my understanding, I think it's like you containerize your application and then you plug it into Convox. Convox kind of takes the baton from there. And I don't know if it uses Fargate on AWS or what exactly it uses, but it basically abstracts everything away from you. So very similar to Heroku, you don't have to worry about your infrastructure. You can focus on other stuff. So that sounds pretty compelling, but I myself haven't like used that tool yet.
Yeah, I spent a couple hours on a weekend trying to sit down and use Convox. I found that documentation is basically non-existent. So if you get anywhere near off the beaten path and have to troubleshoot something, right, like you hit an error message or whatever, the docs for it are just not there. I get the impression that they just released a big new major version. So like, I think that's probably why that's the case, because it's been around for a while. I think it's been around for like 3 or 4 years. But the way they just did like a big re-architect, I think. So like the docs are just not there for hobbyists like you and I to go and figure that out. But it does use Terraform underneath, right? So I got started getting into Terraform and figuring out what was going on with what is going on there, which kind of got me into like declarative infrastructure. And that's kind of where I've been playing for the last 2 weeks. You know, it's like, when you encounter a tool that like is trying to abstract a lower level tool, and then you hit the leaks in the abstraction, right? Like you hit the seams where like the abstraction didn't work. The best course of action at that point is then to go learn the lower level tool, because then you can rebuild that abstraction yourself or figure out what the holes were that they didn't plug. So that was my approach with Convox. It was like, well, if what they're papering over in Terraform and other tech is not working 100% for a complete lay user like me, then I have to go learn the lower level stuff. So that's what I've been doing, mostly with just simple stuff with Terraform over the last week.
So my conversation with Kelsey Hightower was really illuminating for me, because it kind of clarified this is for what, in the sense of like, you hear all these terms, Kubernetes, Docker, Terraform, Chef, Puppet, Ansible, etc. And it's kind of like, what are all these? What's apples to apples and what's not? And what I took away from that conversation was that you can cobble together your own infrastructure on AWS or whatever your platform is. You can cobble together your own unique thing, but it's kind of analogous to building your own PHP application with no framework behind it or something like that. Let's go with the analogy of a custom PHP application. Your application is going to look totally different from anybody else's. You're going to interact with the database a little bit differently. You're going to have your MVC style different from anything else.
This was a big problem in JavaScript before React came along. Like, I don't know if you remember like Backbone days, but like Backbone was a much lower level framework. And so every front-end JavaScript app was architected completely differently from all the other ones, right? So I think that's still more of a problem than, well, Rails is like the most like reified, sort of like regimented, like organization structure I've ever come into contact with. So like everything compared to Rails is going to feel more like wild, but like it used to be crazy in JavaScript too. But yeah, I think the word you used on Twitter was Snowflake, which I like.
Yeah. So
Snowflake architecture.
Yeah, I mean, the first place that I came across that was the term Snowflake server, which is a server that you set up manually. And the danger with that is, what if that server dies? The configuration of that server is not recorded anywhere other than maybe your foggy memory from when you did it some time ago. And so that's bad. And if you need to like replicate that server, create a few new instances of it for scaling or for whatever purpose, it's hard because you just have to do it all manually again. But what I wanted to say about the, so I was using the analogy of the custom PHP app versus Rails. I kind of understand Kubernetes to be kind of analogous to Rails versus putting together your own infrastructure yourself, even if you're using some kind of tool, like I'm using Ansible right now. But Kubernetes is, okay, here's one example Kelsey and I talked about. In my setup right now, I have a load balancer with a number of EC2 instances behind it. I set up that load balancer manually. It's a Snowflake load balancer. And so like, if somebody comes in after me, let's say I die of getting hit by a train, let's say. It was very important for me to include a specific way of me dying in this example. Anyway, I forgot what I was even talking about.
No, I get it. So like Terraform has been solving this need for me pretty well in that particular case. So what I've really liked about Terraform is things like that. So like in Terraform, if I want to set up a couple of EC2 instances behind a load balancer, I write that out in HCL. So that's the language that Terraform uses to create these configs. And all of the config that is relevant to how this load balancer works and what it has to do and what the listeners are and all that stuff is written out in my Terraform HCL files. When I run Terraform, then it sort of generates this state representation that says, okay, you need to have a load balancer in EC2. It's going to have these listeners. It's going to be this type of load balancer and all the, it's going to have this SSL certificate and all that. Right. And then it figures out, okay, do you have that or not? And it does that using its state representation. And it says, okay, so we don't have that. And then the other magic is it figures out, well, all right, so these are all the AWS API calls we have to make that happen. Which was always, I hate interacting with AWS CLI. Like as soon as you get to that point, you're like, oh, we've gone off the rails here. Like this is bad. But Terraform, I've never had to touch the underlying CLI tools. So I don't, where I'm still confused, where I'm still learning, because I haven't like exhausted how much I want to learn about Terraform and infrastructure provisioning yet, is not so much the infrastructure provisioning, which I feel like I'm getting a handle on, but the provisioning of the box itself, right? So like something has to run, is running on that EC2 server, right? That EC2 instance. So like a Rails app, a Go app, or whatever.
Sorry, let me interrupt you there, because let me finish up something from what I was saying before, and then I want to talk about this, because this is the exact thing that I've been thinking about lately, is this setting up the machine like you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But just to tie up that thing from before, Kubernetes, I understand, is built by people who like have been doing this infrastructure stuff for super long, and they like have a single way of doing things that like they know is just good. And so like I wouldn't have to manually specify my load balancer. Just by nature of the fact that I'm using Kubernetes, it'll decide that I need a load balancer and make my load balancer configuration for me, so I don't even have to think about it. So I don't know what other stuff like that is like that inside of Kubernetes, but that seems really appealing to me. Okay, to come back to setting up the machine itself, I'm curious what your thoughts are in this area, because I've been using Ansible to configure my server machine. How have you been doing things?
I haven't gotten this far yet. So like with Terraform so far, I've been messing with static sites and just like uploading static files somewhere and letting someone else deal with the serving, right? So I'm not setting up my own Nginx or my own anything like that. So I haven't come up against this problem yet. But of course, like, you know, you want to deploy a Rails app, it's the other half of this equation. So like I can provision the box now in a way that's declarative and makes sense. But how do I then get the box in the right state where it's ready to serve my Rails application on port 80? And that's obviously where tech like Docker comes in and Ansible. And so Terraform doesn't mess with that at all. So like basically Terraform says, you know, whatever's on that box, you know, is up to you. It only interacts with the cloud provider itself, and the actual, you know, everything you would SSH and do or whatever, that's not Terraform's responsibility. And I actually kind of like that. It's very clear about that. And there's the tech in Terraform for provisioning is, there's actually I think they call them provisioners. And there's an explicit line in the docs that are like, don't use these. Like if you're using these, this is a bad sign, right? And I kind of like that. It's like very clear about what this tool is supposed to be used for and what it's not. So for me, what I am interested in is something that abstracts my Rails server into a declaratively configured thing that I can just Rails server start, but it installs dependencies, starts the services like the database, or in production, you know, connects me to the right thing, and provides this sort of like config file is the source of all truth, and we can just call that thing, and then the server's ready to go, right? Like the bin setup pattern we used to do, but like on steroids and actually what happens in production, okay? Mm-hmm. And this solves a number of problems, I think. So it solves a lot of problems around dev end setup. Like we all have had this experience of like going into a new job and then having to set up the app for the first time and then learning all of this Snowflake stuff. And then maybe you get 80% of it into a README file or something that then, you know, later gets out of date like 15 minutes later, and it just sucks. And like, it feels like there's this tech out here now that is going to help us to deal with that problem. Like, it almost feels like every Rails app should have a test case that starts you from a blank server and then gets you to the correct root response. Like, it should get my app at port, or should ping localhost, I guess, on port 3000, and then get the app response, right? Like we should all have a test that gets us from that blank server state to this.
That's actually a really good idea.
And I think Docker and other tech like that is meant to solve this problem. I have been turned off by Docker in the past because it just wasn't there, and the experience wasn't there. So like there was this big issue on Docker for Mac which I believe has been solved now, but I haven't worked with Docker again, like, in enough detail yet to know, with disk cache. But, like, your Docker disk cache would end up being, like, 100 gigs or something, like, just after, like, running the same, you know, Docker up, like, 10 times. I think they fixed that now. I don't know. But it does feel like containerization as a concept is, like, the way that we probably should be going to solve this issue.
Yeah, I was definitely very motivated after my conversation with Kelsey, and you're going to hear my super loud keyboard as I'm pulling a couple things up here for our conversation. But I was very motivated to try Docker because I haven't been using Docker in my work because, again, I'm the only person, I'm the only developer. But Kelsey made the point of, what if I leave the organization? Somebody else who comes after me, they're going to have to get the application set up on their computer. Somebody else is going to have to get the application set up on their computer at some point, regardless.
I mean, but and my point is, like, everybody has the somebody else because the somebody else is production, right? Like, everybody has to do this.
Yeah, that is totally true. Yeah, and right now I'm using Ansible, like I said, and I'll share a little bit of this with you, Nate, just what's in my setup here. So I have three Ansible playbooks. They're called playbooks. And it's almost like a shell script, except the difference between this and a shell script is it's more similar to that Terraform concept you were describing, where it says, does this thing exist in this particular desired state? Oh, it does? Okay, I'll leave it alone. Or, oh, no, it doesn't? Okay, I'll do whatever is necessary to get it to that state. Mm-hmm. So my first playbook I have is one that will launch an EC2 instance. And that one's kind of disconnected from anything else. Once I launch that instance, it specifies, like, the instance type that I need, the image that I want to use, and how many of them. Once I have that, I have another playbook that is for provisioning. So this particular one, it installs Bundler, it installs libpqdev, which is necessary for PostgreSQL. Then I install the PostgreSQL client. So not PostgreSQL itself, but the CLI that lets you interact with PostgreSQL. There's just a couple more things. It installs Yarn. It changes a certain Nginx setting, changes the max file upload size in Nginx because the default is, like, too small. It copies all my environment variables, and then it updates the passenger config. So that's what the provision script does. And then I'll just real briefly go over my deploy script. This one's longer, so I'll only mention, like, a couple high points from it. But this it'll update my environment variables. It will clone my Rails project from GitHub. It will run bundle install, precompile the assets, run the migrations. You kind of get the idea.
Yep.
So that's working out pretty well. And you can kind of see how, like, even if I were using Docker, a lot of this stuff would probably still have a place. Like, I'm still going to need to run my migrations. There's something in here that restarts Sidekick. I'm probably going to still do that. Docker is not going to do that stuff for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the what's interesting about all this is it feels like the tools for build my own Heroku or, like, Heroku anywhere are sort of there. Like, it's all out here now. Heroku didn't have this stuff when they started it, right? Like, Docker, Terraform, none of this stuff existed when Heroku first came out. And now all the tooling is there, but it feels like it's only accessible to a group of people that are very have a lot of time and are very, like, well versed in this sort of thing already. And but it just feels so like tantalizingly close when you describe like that Ansible playbook of like, God, shouldn't there be some combination of all these technologies that just will deploy a typical Rails app? So, you know, Rails with Puma or Unicorn, with a database, maybe a Redis and a Memcache, to any number of like cloud services, right? Like,
it just, I think Convox is that thing. I know it has the shortcoming of, you know, you try to set it up and the documentation.
It's definitely trying to sit there. Yeah. Like, yeah. It's like, because it's a combination of Terraform, Docker, and like all the technologies that you would have to combine for this. But yeah, personally, on my own experience with it, I think it's like more like a lot of these tools I've found, as I said, you know, they're created by and for the sort of like DevOps priesthood, and it's people that are open sourcing the tools that they use in their day-to-day work, right? So like Convox feels like the open source version of a framework that they use on consulting projects to like deploy people's apps for them, right? So like it's derived from the commonality of like all these different people's apps that they do DevOps consulting for. And there's a lot of projects out there like that that are just like, this is the software for our DevOps consulting. But they're just like, because they're designed for use, usually it's just being used by the one organization that wrote the tool. And also, I think they're sort of targeted at this like I call them DevOps priesthood, that it's not yet ready for like the, I don't want to call it a hobbyist audience because that's being a little bit too diminutive, but like the five engineers and less audience, the no full-time DevOps audience.
Yeah. Well, the term layperson is actually, the term layperson is appropriate. I actually looked up the etymology of layperson the other day, and the original meaning of layperson is like somebody who's in the church, but they're not a member of the clergy.
The laity.
Yeah, if you have the DevOps priesthood, then of course you could have the lay people too.
Yeah,
I think that's totally correct. And I imagine the reason that that's the way it is because of that curse of knowledge. These people get so familiar with these tools that they use and these practices that they use that they can't imagine anybody not knowing them. And so they're just like, oh, here, obviously you just like Dockerize your application and then you put it on Fargate and you're good. Like, what's the problem?
Yeah, I definitely feel like this pattern of declarative configuration and all the tools that are out there now are a major change from the state of the world 5 years ago, when these tools and these concepts were either just getting written for the first time or weren't as widely known as they are now. So it's an exciting time, I feel like, because it feels like the tools are out there, but the putting together, the gluing of these tools has not yet happened in a easy to use and grok way. I mean, Heroku is what I'm talking about, but it now feels like there is the tooling out there to build this anywhere and for anyone.
So why not Heroku?
I don't know. Do you mean like why hasn't Heroku done this, or why are we not satisfied with Heroku?
The latter.
So for me personally, there's a number of places that I want to get off the rails with Heroku, and there's really no way to do that. The common points where this becomes a problem in Heroku. Number one, right-sizing the container. So there is a huge jump on Heroku between the regular dyno sizes and performance dyno sizes. The performance M dyno is like a bad halfway house that charges you 10 times as much for like 2 times the amount of compute and memory resources. So I don't tell anyone to use it. So that just leaves the 2X dyno and the perf L. And those are a 10X price difference, right? So I think, I think I'm right about that. It's $50 to $500 a month. And there's no in between. So a lot of people end up having to deploy to production with one perf L dyno, which is obviously not ideal. It's not easy to auto scale because your minimum sort of like scaling step is this massive 14 gig dyno. And there just feels like a lot of room for the in-between that doesn't exist on Heroku. So that's one thing. The other one is Heroku's dyno types are pretty old. So I haven't tested this in a while, so I can't speak quite up to date on this. But as of at least a year or two ago, Heroku was running perf dynos on C3 series instances. And that's two generations old. So there's a considerable amount of single thread performance that's left on the table with Heroku today. And if you were running your own infrastructure with Terraform, that would be as easy as a Terraform destroy apply and, you know, change the thing into config. The other thing that I feel like the other big pain point I see with a lot of my customers and students is the database. So a lot of people end up moving off of Heroku Postgres to Amazon RDS because the connection limits on Heroku are set extremely low. They basically want you to use PG Bouncer, but PG Bouncer is really hard to use.
I need to ask a clarifying question. When you say they move off of Heroku's database service AWS RDS, do you mean as part of their entire migration off?
Right. Yeah, they're just running Heroku, but pointing the database URL to an RDS instance.
Okay, I never imagined you could do that, but I guess I can't think of any reason why not. Yeah,
exactly.
You just change.
And they're all in the same data center, right? Like, it's Heroku's on AWS, so it's like there's no latency penalty. So like it's just the same data center, no problem.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
So that's a pretty common pattern I've seen as apps get big. They move the database off first. Because Heroku's Postgres product, when you get into the higher tiers, is just not competitive price-wise. And the connection thing is a major issue. The PG Bouncer config is way too easy to footgun yourself. I've unfootgunned a number of PG Bouncer configs. People
Footgun?
Like shooting yourself in the foot.
Got it. Footgun. Okay.
Yeah. So like it's so easy to do because you basically end up bottlenecking your dynos on database connections. So you provide them too few, and then all of your threads and processes start blocking on waiting for an empty database connection, but it's silent. There's no way to really see it easily. And there's no warning that's thrown up. So people do that all the time. I've had to unfootgun a number of these things. And you know, RDS, the connection limits are 10 times bigger for the same price. And so people just don't even have to bother with PG Bouncer. Whatever Amazon is doing to allow these massive connection limits, it works. So like we just switch people to RDS and there's no problem. So there's just a number of places like that in Heroku where I just want to get off the rails just a little bit. And there's no way to do it, you know? And the problem then is like when you start to go off the rails with Heroku a little bit, then you start running into snowflakes. Like the RDS becomes a snowflake, right? Like before, when you like had everything in the Heroku web, when you lived completely in the Heroku web UI, everything was fine because the web UI is good. But when you start to get off that, then you start running back into the snowflake problem and you're back in it. So
I can imagine the pain, yeah.
You can alleviate that a little bit because there is a Heroku provider for Terraform. I've never seen anyone use it, but because I haven't worked on any project with Terraform actually, but like I would alleviate it that way. I would now, if I was going to move anything off of Heroku, I would just abandon the Heroku web UI completely and do everything with Terraform now. But that's not what people do. That's not where most people are at right now. So yeah, there's just a number of little problems like that. And you know, I've always been somebody who the cost difference on Heroku, like I've been a big defender, I guess, of that. Like I know what I'm paying for, like I know what people are paying for, and I think it makes sense. I'm not trying to switch to other platforms or interested in other platforms because I think Heroku is too expensive. I think that's ridiculous. because what we're paying for is the ease of use. But what I'm interested in now is just like, it feels like this, there's something out there that a combination of tools that could create this ease of use for Rails applications in particular, but could allow you to deploy to any platform with any infrastructure.
We mentioned Convox. Are you familiar with Cloud 66?
No.
So Cloud 66, the guy has a couple podcast interviews out there, but it's a similar deal. I'm going to go to Cloud 66 right now. But basically, it's actually super similar to Convox. Okay, I'm on the page right now. Last time I was here, it mentioned about Kubernetes. But I even went so far as to try to set up a Rails application on Cloud 66 on one occasion. But you basically, it works like this. You plug in your AWS credentials into the Cloud 66 UI, and Cloud 66 will talk to AWS, set up some infrastructure for you, get your app going. In theory, I didn't get this far with it, but basically does that same idea. So this idea, it kind of does exist in a couple incarnations, but yeah. You know, there's nothing to like the Heroku level of quality yet, it seems like.
Yep. And it just feels to me too, like Rails applications are so simple. Like there's so many commonalities in Rails deployments. Like we all have the exact same technical stack. Like we have horizontally scalable web servers. We have a load balancer. We have a couple of databases, and that's kind of it. And it just feels like, like I said, some of this stuff is, it feels like even when it's abstracted, even when these frameworks come out or Convox, that it almost feels like there could even be another layer on top of it that was like, this is how to provision a Rails app, right? It just feels all so close, but just not there.
Yeah. I have had the same exact thought so many times, and somebody should make it.
Yeah, somebody, some dear listener. I'm going to get into the Ansible and Docker and that sort of the machine provisioning side soon. And I'll be excited to see what I learned from the state of tooling there. Because like I said, Docker was kind of a train wreck like 5 years ago when I last tried it. What I want to talk about now, though, is like we started, you know, brainwaving on Twitter about that once you start thinking with this like declarative config, no more snowflakes concept, suddenly everything looks like a snowflake, right? Like you see snowflakes everywhere. You're like, oh my God,
yeah,
my iPad is a snowflake. Yeah. So like DevEnv, what have you been thinking about on that, your dev laptop side?
Oh, that was like, I don't know. I just saw your couple tweets about it. And I'm like, holy shit, I have a snowflake laptop. This is crazy. I'm not going to do anything about it anytime soon. But
because
I
think one sort of attempt at this that was tried, was popular a couple of years back, was Vagrant, right? Like there was a phase, I feel like, where everybody was going to do their dev ends with Vagrant and everyone was going to rub their dev end on a VM. But that never really came to pass. So what we were talking about on Twitter, if you haven't seen the conversation, was I was reading a lot on Hacker News about NixOS. So this is an operating system that I guess is popular in the functional programming community. And the idea is that your whole operating system is managed with these config files. Like you start with nothing and then you build up the config file and it's like it's stateless because you can just... The crazy thing that got me hooked was this, how he was talking about how he can actually upgrade his entire operating system, he being the author of NixOS, I believe, by rimriff /*. So like you can't in NixOS blow away the config directory and like one other directory. but you can blow away everything else while the operating system is running and then swap in something else because of the way it's set up. And it was just like, what the? Like, yeah. Dude, if we could do that.
You can
that,
say fuck like, on the show if you want to.
Oh, okay, cool. so, like, that was a little bit like, wait a minute, like, what if we could do that? And then I, you know, tweeted, and it turns out people are interested in this and doing it to, like, a sort of hack-together extent on Mac. Chris Seaton described that he basically just does everything in a cloud environment. So I imagine he's probably on some sort of, like, Oracle tool chain with that. But other people described combinations of, like, Homebrew, I forget the name of the tool now, but somebody showed, like, linked this tool that was like sort of like application provisioning by script for Mac. So it was like, you know, you write all your app list in there and all the config for it. But the idea is just like, never use config UI, put all of your config into this one or list of files. And so that, you can blow everything away. Just have this file of that represents the state of your dev end and or your machine, and then roll it all back. And yeah, unfortunately, you know, even macOS now is this big ball of terrible state that just gets messed up over time, and you have to reinstall the OS. You know, it's like that's the world we live in.
The funny thing is, when I said Snowflake laptop, I wasn't even thinking about programming. I was just thinking about, like, if I look at my icon tray here, the things on here that aren't native, I have Chrome, Slack, Spotify, Evernote, ScreenFlow, some other stuff. If I get a new computer, I'm going to have to reinstall all this stuff, and it's kind of laborious.
Or you do, like, the migration assistant, and then you migrate over all this, like, polluted state that you don't know about, right? Like, all the stuff in application support, all the stuff in library, like all this stuff that gets screwed up over the 5 years that you're walking around with your home directory or whatever it's been. You know, like I was saying on Twitter, my Spotlight just crashes randomly now. So I fixed it temporarily by changing to Alfred, and maybe I'll stick with it. I don't know. But like, I kind of prefer to be like on the system tools as much as possible. Like, I don't want to, I'm not going to switch to like a third party tool just to get the extra 10%. But like I have to, cause Spotlight just doesn't even work anymore.
Oh, no.
So I got me thinking about this. And so, yeah, I feel like I've somehow like taken a red pill here, and like everything is Snowflakes, and I just want to fix everything. And
you know, too much. There's no going back.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm interested in that now too. I haven't done anything on that front yet.
Well, we have covered a litany of topics during this conversation. There was this one occasion where I listened to this podcast. Well, maybe I shouldn't say what it was, but I listened to this podcast episode, and these two guys were just talking so fast about all this stuff, and I got like 20 minutes into it, and I'm just like, I have no idea what these guys are talking about. They were obviously super smart, and they were just like really, really jamming or whatever in their conversation. They were just back and forth talking about all this stuff. And I just like, I couldn't grab onto anything. I was just completely lost. And I bet that this podcast that we just recorded is like that for somebody listening. They're like, what are Nate and Jason talking about?
I hope people understand that that's not because, if you do feel confused or like a little bit overwhelmed right now, it's not because it's not your fault. It's just the state of this tooling now. It's my fault. The state of this tooling right now is all over the place. Like, that's the problem that we've, I think, been talking about for the last however many minutes, is like, there's two dozen really great pieces of this puzzle here, and they all do one little part, and but to the experience that we want requires putting them all together. So, yeah, I hope it's at least been a little bit interesting.
Yeah, I'm sure it has been. Well, I mean, just anything that I talk about is automatically fascinating, because I'm a really fascinating person. But yeah. No, I think this was really good, and more Well, I think people are hungry for more understanding in this area. That's the impression I get from talking to people. So, dear listener, if you've heard anything that we said and you're like, I want to hear more about Kubernetes or whatever, let me know. You can send me an email, jason@codewithjason.com. I'll try to cover this stuff more on future podcast episodes, blog posts, and stuff like that. Because I'm just diving into this stuff myself, too. I'm learning it, and I'm happy to share my learnings in real time. This is probably a good place to wind it down. So, Nate, we haven't talked like at all about what you do, although we did have that previous episode where we talked more about Rails performance.
Yeah.
But can you just, before we go, do you want to tell people a little bit about the work you do, just like super briefly, and then like where people can find you online?
So I'm a performance and scaling consultant for Ruby web applications. I help people make their applications better for customers to use, more fun to use because they're faster, and to scale them for cheaper and with less headache. So I do that by consulting, but also I wrote a book called The Complete Guide to Rails Performance, and I occasionally do workshops on the same topic. So you can find me at speedshop.co, which is feeling faster than ever, I must say, after I put in some work with Terraform and Netlify and another litany list of technologies that we can save for another episode.
Yeah, I don't know if this is in the works, but I hope you do some kind of write-up on here's what I did with Terraform and blah, blah, blah to make my site faster.
Yeah, I gotta stabilize it all first. It's kind of relies on some very bleeding edge tech right now, actually. That is in the pipe.
Nice. Well, I'll look forward to that. Nate, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, no problem.